Hi, welcome to Ryan Talks Tax, a podcast to keep you up to date on the latest developments in Canadian tax and government funding. I'm your host, Jim Day. Well, it's that time of the year again, when Canadians start thinking about filing their personal income taxes. But before they can do that, corporate accounting and tax departments have to contend with T4 filing requirements, if they haven't done so already, including any taxable benefits that might have been received by their employees or shareholders. And then there's the GST, HST, and potentially QST impact of those taxable benefits, which also needs to be thought about. To bring us up to date on current issues related to payroll and taxable benefit reporting, we're joined in this episode by two experts on the subject: Jeffrey Shaw, Director of Ryan's Client Support Services Group, and a frequent guest on the podcast. Welcome back, Jeff. And we've also got Carrie Thomas, an independent payroll tax advisor who is affiliated with Ryan. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jim.
Jeff, maybe we'll start with you. I know you recently completed a couple of webinars on the subject of taxable benefits and the GST, HST implications of those benefits. Maybe let people know about that important deadline that's coming up.
Okay, so there's important filing deadlines for T4 at the end of February, and included in that would be the requirement to calculate any tax on taxable benefits that might come up. So the reporting for the T4 is going to include an employee's base pay. But in addition to that, anything above and beyond their base pay needs to be added, that they've received from their employer needs to be added to their T4. So simple things like taxable allowances and things like that, additional pay in that regard would be included on it. But other things that you might have to consider might be things, other tangible type items that are provided to an employee, a car, a vacation, gifts and awards, those sort of things. They need to be tallied up and included on the T4.
That's a really good point. And I know along with the actual taxable benefit itself comes this potential GST, HST, or in some cases a QST remittance. And I know you don't have time to go through the whole webinar you just completed, but maybe just give us a brief description of the rationale behind that remittance.
Okay, well, first of all, the remittance triggers because we've included an amount on a T4, and basically we're going to decide to include an amount on the T4 because the employer has given it to the employee. And so the rationale there of putting it on the T4 is to try and put the employee in the same position as if they had bought the item with their own money in after-tax dollars. So to do that, we put it on the T4 and then it's taxed. So there's a second piece to the equation, is that if the employer has bought something and given it to their employee and it becomes a taxable benefit, then and the item that they provided to the employee was a taxable item, they would have paid GST, HST, and QST. And if they were in commercial activities, there's a big likelihood that they will have claimed an input tax credit or an input tax refund to recover the sales taxes that were paid on that. So if that item becomes a taxable benefit and added onto someone's T4, the employer really needs to repay that input tax credit because they weren't entitled to it in that case, because it was really something that belonged to the employee, not the employer. So it wasn't part of the employer's commercial activity. And so instead of just having them reverse the input tax credit, there's a requirement for them, for the employer, to remit sales tax on the value of the benefit. And that's accomplished by using a factor of the taxable benefit amount. And there's a whole bunch of things that can cause problems there. One is it can be difficult to actually properly value the taxable benefit. And then we have some situations where maybe the employee might reimburse some of the cost, and that can factor into whether the amount that we remit GST on takes into those reimbursements into account, or even the timing of when we have to remit the tax. So a lot of things can play into properly remitting tax on taxable benefits.
Yeah, that's true, Jeff. The valuation of the benefit itself can be quite difficult. And as I mentioned, you recently completed some webinars on the subject. I should mention to the listeners, you can find on-demand versions of those webinars on our website at ryan.com/Canada under the training tab. So if you do want more information on sort of the ins and outs of doing that tax remittance calculation, some pointers on calculating the taxable benefit itself, that information's there for you as well. Carrie, did you have anything to add in terms of challenges you're seeing with taxpayers maybe struggling to determine the value of a benefit?
Nothing in particular, Jim. I guess it's the one of the issues has to be, I suppose, the assumption that the cost that an employer incurs to acquire something is the value. Cost really is a proxy in many cases for value, and it can be accepted by the CRA depending on the circumstances. But the value which should be referred to, at least technically, is the fair market value of an item as opposed to the cost. And the difference sometimes can be significant, and a CRA auditor would have the legal authority to look to the fair market value of an item given to an employee, perhaps as a taxable reward, as opposed to the cost incurred by the employer.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I never thought of that. Maybe in some cases, the fair market value might be significantly different than the actual cost to the employer, which I guess would have to be factored into that calculation. So I was on the CRA's website the other day, hard to believe, I know, but I noticed the simplified calculation for the home office expense deduction is no longer available for the 2023 tax year. So I just got to wondering, like from a taxable benefit perspective, have there been any similar kind of changes? I mean, I know the deduction I just talked about was a COVID relief or a simplification measure. Were there changes related to taxable benefits along the same lines?
I don't see a lot this year. There's some tinkering and refinements. The gifts and rewards policy has been refined, I guess is maybe a good word for it, over the last year. There's now more opportunities for the provision of a gift certificate to be termed or fit into the gifts and awards policy. In the past, it was carved out because it was near cash. And so now that's been broadened by the CRA, and actually it now kind of matches the rules that are in place for Quebec purposes. So I think that's a good thing that the two policies are aligned. So there's that. And then, they've made some clarifications. So they always called it the gifts and awards policy. But now they've introduced another term, which I think, kind of crystallizes some things in my mind, but they've introduced the term reward. So anything that's not a gift and award is a reward, and any type of reward is a taxable benefit. And I always looked at it as just gifts and awards, and awards are typically related to like long-term service type things. So they can only be granted every 5 years generally. I thought anytime an employer gave anything else, it was always a gift, but gifts are only for special occasions. So birthdays, Christmas, weddings, that sort of thing. Any other time the employer gives something, it's really a reward because it's likely tied to performance, and therefore it's a taxable benefit. And I think that's an area that is often misunderstood and confused. I know many, many, many years ago, I was at an employer, and to make the employees happy, they gave them $500 amounts, which conveniently fit into the gift policy. The employee could go out and really purchase anything they wanted to. This was just something to make them happy. But under the policy, that really wouldn't fit in a gift because it wasn't for my birthday or anyone else's birthday or a wedding or Christmas. And so I think they've really clarified that. And it's probably really important now that so many organizations are involved in reward programs, where people on a day-to-day basis can be rewarded for doing a good job, not just from senior management or their boss, but coworkers or people in another department, and they can be awarded points, and then those points can be converted into gift certificates or into products that they might want for use at home or something. And those things have all now been clearly defined as taxable benefit because it's a reward, not a gift. So I think that's an important distinction.
Yeah, definitely. A very important distinction. And maybe just remind everyone about the significance of fitting into that gifts and awards policy. There's quite a benefit there, isn't there?
Yeah, if it fits in as a gift and award, the item is not a taxable benefit. And so the limit on both categories is $500. So as long as the total amount of gifts and awards is $500 or under, then it's not a taxable benefit. And the company is able to deduct the expense on their corporate income tax return. So there is quite a benefit to being able to do that. If it's a reward, then the item is really for the exclusive personal use of the employee. And so it becomes a taxable benefit. And the company potentially doesn't have an opportunity to deduct that expense for income tax purposes. So that it's important to really understand where, you know, which side of the coin you're on in those, whether they're taxable or not, and deductible for income tax purposes.
And obviously, I guess if you made a mistake there, that could really add up, particularly if you're dealing with a large number of employees.
I think so. I think, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, our own organization, Ryan, has an employee reward program. And I can only imagine how much money is filtered through that. And so if you magnify that by, you know, I just know myself, I claimed some rewards probably in the couple of hundred dollar range last year. If everyone at Ryan was part of that, multiply a couple hundred dollars or more by 2,000 or 3,000 people, that's a fair bit of money. Now that's all in Canada, but you know, there could be an organization that we're talking about today that's completely in Canada, and all those rewards might have a Canadian tax consequence. $200 a head sort of thing multiplied by tax could be a significant amount of money.
For sure, I definitely think so. I remember during the pandemic, there was a special policy in place. I think it was for home office equipment purchases. I think you could get a certain amount provided by the company without it being a taxable benefit. Is that still in place or is that an annual policy? How does that work? Do you know?
Good question. And we get lots of questions about it. So that was a one-time payment that was provided early on in the pandemic. I think it was like, you know, it was within the first year it was permitted, and it was really a situation that was put in place to help organizations pivot from having all their employees working in the office to having them all working at home, and to make sure that they could be as efficient as possible. They could help out the employees by buying home office equipment or providing an amount for home office equipment so the employee could go out and get a printer or an office chair or a monitor, whatever they wanted. And so that was a one-time allotment. You could make that payment once and it would not be a taxable benefit. But we do get that question fairly often. What about that payment? I think the deductibility or the non-taxation of that equipment was spread over a couple of years, but you could still only make one payment. So there was a lot of confusion around that. People or some organizations, I think, believe that they can make that payment every year and it doesn't trigger taxation. And that's certainly not the case.
Well, it sounds like it would be important to check on that then before making any further payments along those lines. Make sure you've got the tax status correct. The other thing that happened, obviously, during the pandemic, lots of people working from home. And many of them have continued to work from home, which kind of brings us to another issue, because it's already kind of tricky sometimes to determine whether or not an employer has a permanent establishment in a particular province. And now you might have employees working from all over the place, you know, throughout the country. So I think it's probably make it even more tricky to figure out whether or not you've got a PE in a province. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'd agree. You know, I think at the end of the day, if someone worked in an office and then the pandemic came along and they now started to work from home and they continued to work from home, nothing has really changed. They're still going to report to work at the location that they did physically report to work. But you know, that whole situation now where employees can now work from home full-time, part-time, or whatever, can make it a little bit trickier. to determine where they actually report to work. And so the government has created a new, I don't know if it's a new policy, but they do have a web page that deals with the determination of the province of employment for employment income purposes. And it can walk you through it, ask you a bunch of questions. And what they're trying to determine is really where you report to work. And there's some new terminology in there that might be a little bit confusing, because now instead of where you report to work, they often are looking to a location that you're attached to. Because if you're physically not going into someplace, you're really not reporting to that location. So there's a bunch of indicators that you can look at. And guess what? Like, one of the easiest ones was, hey, if you reported to work previously at a location and all that's changed is now you're working from home, you're continuing to report to that same location. And there's a whole bunch of other factors that you can look at. And most of them are fairly obvious, right? You know, if you needed a new laptop and they didn't send it in the mail to you, where would you go and pick it up? That's where you're attached to work, sort of thing. So most of them make sense. But when you go through that, the kind of questionnaire, there are some anomalies in there that you know, you have to be careful of. So, you know, if you fit into one of those anomalies, you might need Kerry Thomas to help you out to figure out the lay of the land, so to speak.
Yeah, really good point. Kerry, let's bring you in here. If I record this podcast from the Yukon, does that mean Ryan has a permanent establishment in the Yukon now?
It depends. Following up from Jeff's comments about the relatively recent change that the CRA has implemented with respect to the idea of reporting to an establishment, I'm happy in a way that the CRA has, I guess, its administrative policy has evolved to reflect or recognize, I guess, current working conditions. To your question about the Yukon, if they've hired you as a remote employee and you're attached to Ryan's offices in Mississauga, attached by way of a reporting relationship, supervisory relationship, where you're hired from, these are factors. So in all likelihood, you would be attached to, but you yourself would not be a PE in the province, in the territory, in the Yukon territory. What's happening, from a tax compliance perspective, is a good thing, because the rules regarding, the approach regarding attachment is consistent with the approach taken by employer health tax administrators in British Columbia and Ontario. Probably in Manitoba as well by now. I'm more familiar with Ontario and BC. The concept of attachment is built into their legislation. And from an administrative perspective, they have their own bulletins. And my guess is that the bulletins for EHT, Employer Health Tax, or BC and Ontario would have wording, which is not wholly dissimilar from the factors that are listed on the CRA website. So there's an element of harmonization between provincial tax statutes and the feds. And the other aspect, which is with respect to the remote workers, employer reporting to an establishment, has an impact with respect to payroll deductions. So the default position has been in the past, if you weren't reporting physically to work at a location, the default, they would then look at to what place you were paid from, the place of payment. So the source deductions or income tax withholdings would be based on the place of payment. So if you're an Alberta employee, where the provincial tax withholding is relatively light, but you're paid from Ontario, withholdings would be based on Ontario rates. And Alberta employees were not surprisingly dissatisfied with that situation. So in a new environment with a remote worker, if for argument's sake, there's a Calgary office and you can argue this is an attachment, your supervisor happened to have a cubicle or an office in Calgary, you're now attached to that PE, and withholdings will be based on your province of employment, which would now be Alberta, and your net pay increases accordingly. So that's where I see some changes occurring for companies that have taken on a number of remote workers. The idea, I have one tech company, and they've hired a lot of employees in Alberta. This is during the pandemic, perhaps maybe even post-pandemic, and it's rather than having people physically live in the Toronto area, they can hire high quality people at perhaps lower wages, lower salaries in Alberta. and they can look at establishing a PE in Alberta and helping everybody out accordingly.
That's a great clarification, Carrie. I guess while it might seem obvious where an employee is located, it might warrant a little further investigation as far as the tax implications of a remote worker. And for the record, I'm actually recording this episode from our office in Mississauga in case anyone from the CRA happens to be listening. So don't want to put Ryan offside there.
One point of confusion sometimes with employers is the reporting of the province of employment for CRA purposes and workers' compensation coverage. Payroll taxes in the Ryan model include workers' compensation premiums, and workers' compensation premiums are based on the province in which an employee works. So their place of employment determines the WSIB premium rate and the premiums payable. And that may differ from the CRA's approach to attachment. So that for CRA purposes, you'd be looking at the new rules as a remote worker, but for workers' compensation purposes, you're looking at the province in which the individual performs work.
Okay, so it can be different then,
yes,
depending on which tax you're looking at.
Exactly.
Okay, that's really good to know. Yeah, I was just going to say, and of course, all this rolls into the T4 reporting, which I mentioned off the top. And, you know, maybe for our non-Canadian listeners, Carrie, just briefly describe what we're referring to when we say T4 reporting.
Sure. The T4 is the annual information slip that the employer is required to issue, one copy to the employee and multiple copies to the CRA. It's equivalent to the W-2 form, which is used in the U.S. to report employment income. And as Jeff mentioned before, the filing deadline will be the last day of February, which this year will be February 29th. The T4 is a statement of employment income. It includes the compensation received by an employee in the year, including taxable benefits. And with respect to some of the Canadian benefits, some of the issues that I've seen with respect to situations where the payroll for Canadian operations is managed in the U.S. Sometimes the U.S. payroll management team is not as familiar with Canadian tax rules, and because of that, problems occasionally arise. And two that I've seen in the last couple of years involve the inclusion of Canadian employees in what I'll call U.S.-sponsored benefit plans. For example, many U.S. public corporations have what are called restricted stock plans for their employees. And the rules, rightly so, are based on U.S. IRS code rules. And when those plans are overlaid on Canadian employees, there can be some confusion as to how these values should be reported in Canada. So I've had a number of client questions in the last 3 months in particular, as the T4 is being prepared, where Canadian employees have been introduced or become participants for the first time in U.S. plans, and there's confusion about the reporting. Another area has to do with what's called deferred profit sharing plans, where employers have taken advantage of this opportunity over the last 10 or so years, where they're able to have an RSP program for their employees, where the RSP contributions are deducted, and the employer match, rather than going into the RSP, which would make it a form of taxable benefit, the employer contribution can go into the deferred profit sharing plan, which is a DPSP. And that's legitimate. It means that the employer is getting a proper deduction. The employee's taxable benefit situation. However, the DPSP reports typically will come from a third party, from perhaps an insurance company, from a trust company. And if that information doesn't flow properly through the payroll system in time, it means that there's a misreporting in the T4. So there's just two areas where sometimes the U.S. payroll managers you're not familiar with, or perhaps are relying on somebody to feed information on a timely basis. It just doesn't happen.
So there are some tricky situations where, you know, the proper reporting can be a little bit difficult. That's good to know. And I'm guessing, just like with taxable benefits, that could really add up, couldn't it, with a lot of employees, or maybe if it's taking place over several years.
Exactly. The I have a short story involving DPS reporting. Again, situation of a U.S.-based payroll department. Some miscommunication between a third-party administrator and payroll or HR amounts were omitted for 4 years. The implication there is not a direct hit for the employee, but it affects what's called the pension adjustment. There's an item shown on the annual T4, which has an effect on the following year's RSP contribution room for the employee. It's all been resolved now, but there's a large employee communication strategy required to address this issue for all their Canadian employees. And it was certainly, I'd say the employer, pardon me, took what I call a reputational hit, I guess, because of that. I think things have all been amended and corrected now, but it certainly was a blip in their operations. So those, and then the other one with respect to an amount not being reported, that's an amount of compensation or benefit not reported. There's, some misinformation, I guess, maybe it's called old information, where some companies will believe that if we, made a mistake on the T4, we can correct it by adding back the amounts of compensation that we should have reported. So we will not take a deduction on our corporate income tax return for these amounts, and we'll resolve it, settle it that way behind the scenes. Starting in about 2010, the CRA has started to take a different approach based on jurisprudence, where if there's been income omitted on a T4, and when an amended T4 is issued, it has to go to the employee, and the employee is reassessed for any tax amount owing plus interest. So the employer is exposed on the misreporting side, and the employee is exposed to a personal tax assessment. And the again, there's a reputational risk for an employer if the T4 information is not, on the income side, is not accurate, reported properly.
Well, I guess so. I think employees would probably not be too happy with their employer creating extra tax issues for them with amended T4s and having to refile and deal with auditors and things like that. Probably not good for the company.
That's why on occasion it's beneficial to, when it's practical, to do a bit of a compliance test before T4s are issued. We're a little bit late now in February, but it's something which you can avoid headaches if you have the opportunity to do some sort of a pre-filing review.
Yeah, that's great advice. And you mentioned that deadline, which is rapidly coming up, and notwithstanding the extra day in the leap year this year, what happens if an employer has trouble making the deadline, or if they miss a deadline? Are there any consequences there as a penalty? Or
there are penalties for late reporting of T4s. You're correct. What we sometimes advise employers to do is to get a T4 out the door if you can beforehand, and then look at the amendment process on a timely basis thereafter.
Okay, that was my next question. If someone's listening to this and maybe it's already past February, we're into March, or we're right at the end of the month, for example, what's your best advice? So if you can get the T4 out, and look at how to amend it after the fact. Is that the best course of action?
If you know that there is an issue with the T4 on filing on up to the 29th, obviously a communication strategy is important, letting your employees know that while we're issuing the T4s to meet the deadline, we may need to, or we know we're going to have to issue amendments in the near future. We apologize for the inconvenience. To be proactive, if you can, if you know there's an issue before the filing deadline, I would suggest getting something out and then letting all parties know that the amendments are in process.
Okay, yeah, that's good to know. I'm looking forward to seeing my T4 for last year as well. I'll be checking it very carefully now, thanks to your advice, Kerry. Taxable benefits, eh? They're great when you get them. Not as great when you see them on your T4 and they go into your taxable income. Well, listen, Kerry, Jeff, great information today. Great discussion as always. I really appreciate it. Kerry, how can a listener with a potential payroll tax issue get a hold of you? What would be the best way?
Probably by email at Kerry Thomas, KerryThomas, .advisor, advisor, at outlook.com.
Okay. And Jeff, I think I know the answer to this question, but how can a listener get a hold of you or your team if they have a concern about a taxable benefit situation or the GST, HST implications of that?
Sure. You can contact us through the phone at 1-800-667-1600 or by sending an email to taxdirect@ryan.com. And also, if you forgot Kerry's email address, you can certainly contact the Tax Direct line through those two methods. Let us know that you would like to connect with Kerry Thomas, and we'll do our best to make the connection.
Okay, well, I hope they will if they have concerns, because as Kerry mentioned, there can be a large reputational risk to an organization if they inadvertently create these kind of problems for their employees. So certainly something to keep an eye on. Thanks again for the great information today.
No problem. Enjoyed it.
Thank you, Jeff.
That concludes this episode of Ryan Talks Tax. Please let us know what you think about the podcast. You can send your questions, comments, or suggestions to events@ryan.com. Thanks for listening.